Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to reintroduce to you today. Dr. Bill Schindler is a returning guest on our show. Be sure to check out his first appearance on episode 14 and more recently on episode 223 of Boundless Body Radio. Dr. Bill Schindler is an archaeologist who has traveled to every corner of the globe to learn about our human roots. In his travels, Dr. Schindler has learned that our current industrialized food system is vastly different than what we have eaten as a species for millions of years. His much-anticipated book, Eat Like a Human, was published in 2021. His goal is to help his readers find and prepare food that is as nutrient-dense as possible. His current passion, the Eastern Shore Food Lab, was created in 2017 as a research and teaching laboratory at Washington College and has become an autonomous nonprofit. Dr. Schindler and his family were instrumental in creating the lab and continuing to direct and expand its programs. Dr. Schindler not only conducts research at the Eastern Shore Food Lab, but also offers hands-on immersive classes on a range of topics, including cheese making, sourdough bread making, nose-to-tail butchering and cooking, fermenting, and foraging. Dr. Bill Schindler, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you back to Boundless Body Radio.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Casey.
Absolutely. Every chance I get, I'm going to thank you and thank you and thank you every single time for being one of our very first guests on our show. When we weren't very popular, we didn't have a lot of people listening, I reached out. I'll never forget the email that you sent back to me. You said, Casey, I would love to be on your podcast. And I just, man, I love that. I was just on the Chatting Fit podcast with my new good friend, Finley McLaren, and we talked about it on air and said exactly the same thing. Like, Finley, I'm guessing that when you reached out to host Dr. Bill Schindler on your show, his team didn't say, like, how many downloads do you have? How popular is the show? I'll bet it was him that answered, and he said yes right away. And he confirmed that absolutely. Dr. Bill Schindler responded himself and was an amazing guest. So,
that's great to hear. I had a wonderful conversation with him. I really enjoyed that one as well.
So. He's great. That was a great conversation. Great conversation. Before we get rolling into things, happy birthday. He turned 50.
I turned 50 a couple days ago. Yes.
Wow. Okay. I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of gripe a little bit here. Aging just sucks, doesn't it? Don't you feel terrible as a 50-year-old now?
You know, I do. I've been saying it lately on the last few podcasts I've been on. And this is my first podcast since I was 50. And it has been for the past few weeks. You know, I'm almost 50 and now I'm 50 and I do. I feel incredible. I really, truly do. I probably the worst health of my life was in my late 20s and my early 30s. And I feel so, so much better now. And, you know, I have some gray. Anybody watching this right now can see I have a little bit of gray. Not a ton, but a little. And when I look in the mirror, I am surprised because in my head, I'm 24 years old running around, truly. And that's how I feel. When I look in the mirror, I get surprised every time. A little bit upset, but I feel incredible. And I owe it to the changes that we've made in our lives over the past 20 years have just been so... so monumental. And the other thing, and I was listening to my buddy Anthony Chafee the other day talk about this, and it's a new goal for me. I was getting a little upset just mentally about turning 50. And, you know, I heard him say, you know, the average lifespan for a human is supposed to be 120 years. And so that's my new goal. I'm not even halfway there yet.
I love that. Bethany, my wife, was asking me the same thing a few weeks ago. I turned 39. And she said, is this messing with your head? Like, how do you feel to turn older? I said, I feel awesome. Like, turning older is acquiring more experiences and gaining wisdom and changing, you know, the way you approach things and doing things a little bit better. It's not about aging and feeling worse. Like, I feel as good as I've ever felt. Like, all the niggling little things I always had, once I changed my diet, they just kind of magically went away. And to wake up with tons of energy and jump right out of bed and go serve in different ways, it feels amazing. I love aging. So I think that is a great example. And I think that's a great goal. Do you agree with him? Yeah. Do you believe that humans should live to be 120?
Well, first off, even if he's wrong, it's a great goal to have. So no matter what, the more that I'm looking into it, I didn't know much about the context, you know, where he was coming from with it. And the more I'm looking into it, the more it makes complete sense. You know, one of the things he says that seems to be holding up the more I dive into it is, you know, traditionally through these oral traditions, different traditional groups around the world, that number 120 keeps coming up over and over and over again. I mean, he gives the cellular and biological data and reasoning behind that 120 year mark. And it makes a lot of sense, but that the fact that that number keeps coming up over and over again is very, very interesting.
Yeah, I love that. And I totally agree. And to be clear, very clear here, we're not saying we're just going to keep your body alive in any particular state until 120. We're actually going to keep you healthy and off of medications until one day you drop dead. It's very different than the way that people age these days.
Yeah, and that's the key. And I love that, because when I was in my 30s, especially my young 30s, I was starting to feel that middle age. You know, I was, and I always say this, when you go walk up the steps and your knees are creaking and they're locking in, or you get up in the morning, your feet are all swollen and your feet hit the ground and you have a certain feeling, cramping up, that all that sort of thing. I was like everybody else, normalizing it. And I understand why, because it is normal. It is normal because of the way we're living today, because of our diets, to feel that way in middle age. But that isn't what should be normal. What has been normal for us as a species is, like other animals, we live at these incredible lives until we keel over dead. And that's the way that I want to live. And whether it's tomorrow, which I hope it's not, or in 70 more years, which is what I'm really banking on, that's what we should be doing. Certainly I'm not going to run on a marathon when I'm 110 years old, but to be able to get up and move around, that's my goal. And the more that I'm living this lifestyle and feeling what it feels to live my best life, the more that at least seems like a real reality for my future.
Absolutely. And with the energy and passion that you have at age 50, I am also willing to bet that you'll make it to 120. That's fantastic.
I hope so.
So this actually happened. I'm sure this has happened to you in some capacity. This week, I had a dream that I was nutrition coaching and I was trying to explain some of the harms of plant toxins. I woke up and realized I'd been working mentally in my head as I was dreaming. And part of that is to say, like, I've become obsessed with this question of what we should be eating, what nutrition should look like. And that is absolutely your same, thing that sort of like really grabbed you for your entire career, is what should we be eating? So before we kind of tackle that and address that, even though you've been on our show twice, can you share with our audience your story and why that became such an obsession of yours as well?
Sure, absolutely. So the quick version, I know we've gone over this in the past, is like so many other people probably listening to this, I was born in 1973, 50 years ago, and grew up a product of the 70s and the 80s, where, we had that food pyramid and everybody was told we should be eating margarine, not butter, reduce saturated fats, get rid of red meats, all the things that, we know is the case. And I grew up an overweight, unhealthy kid. And part of that unhealthiness was my body image. I remember looking in the mirror every chance I had, every time I could see my reflection, every time I walked past the store window at the mall, I would look at myself, feel depressed, suck in my gut. And this is how I spent most of my childhood. And I remember just thinking, this is the time when there were just as many fad diets then as there are today. And Richard Simmons doing the workouts, all those sorts of things. And it was always hitting your face, work out harder, eat less food, go on a diet, and, all your problems will be solved. And I had that mentality. I had this incredibly unhealthy relationship with food, and that mentality that I was at fault, I was doing something wrong. If I could just control my urges and eat the right food, then my entire life would be different. And, one of the other, and this is a horrible thing to say and to admit, but the more that I do these podcasts and the more that I hear feedback from, really honest, genuine stories, the more that I really do want to share what it was like, hopefully to connect and resonate with somebody. But I remember I was probably, I forget exactly my age, I was probably about 12 or 13 years old, really when you're self-conscious. Maybe I was 14, 15, right around then when you really started to realize that girls were around, that sort of thing. I remember I was getting ready to take a shower. And so I was naked and I had to go to the bathroom. So I'm sitting on the toilet and I remember looking down at myself. One of the worst things you can do when you have poor self body image is actually look down at yourself. Right. So I'm looking down at myself and I'm looking at my stomach and my love handles and all of it. And I remember just literally grabbing the fat in my stomach with both my hands and almost in tears and just wishing somebody could tell me what I should be eating. And if they could just tell me what I should be eating, I would do that. I would lose the weight and literally all the problems in my life would be solved. And I've realized now that there were so many things wrong with what I was telling myself at that moment in my life. One of them, there's so many obviously mental things that were wrong with it. But important to this conversation was I was asking myself the wrong question, right? It wasn't just what I should eat. If somebody would tell me what I should eat, I, all my problems we solve, that isn't the case. What I found throughout, you know, my research through all the work that I've done is that we humans approach food differently than every other animal on the planet. And it's a long story. We dove into it a little bit before in earlier podcasts, but the reality is for humans, we have to address two questions at the same time. One is what we should be eating, and it's very important. And that's the question that everybody's addressing. And the other question, which is, I think, what's unique about at some level about my approach, is how we should be eating. And this doesn't just mean when, like intermittent fasting or, you know, those sorts of things, which are all very, very important conversations. What I'm talking about is the technological input required to transform raw materials, almost every ingredient to any food that we eat, into the safest and most nourishing form possible. So I go through there. I become an athlete. I lose a bunch of weight because I'm working out so hard. I'm still eating a terrible diet. Then when I stop becoming a college athlete, all the weight pours back on. And that's when I really experienced the worst health of my life in my 20s and my 30s. And it wasn't until I really just put together all of my anthropological and archaeological research with my love for food and my desire to live this healthier life that I really started to get the answers that I was looking for. And one of the things that I found is that there's a whole bunch of incredible gems in the archaeological record, information that we can use to really create a foundation for understanding what real true human health is. But also there's a lot of holes in the archaeological record, and to patch those holes and to fill some of those gaps and actually bring archaeology to life, I found that traveling and working with indigenous and traditional groups in different parts of the world, like you mentioned earlier, has really, you know, made all the work that I'm doing, like I meant to, come to life and make it more meaningful. So now my family has two entities. We have a nonprofit, like you mentioned, the Eastern Shore Food Lab, which is focused on continuing that research. And I have some exciting things about that I'd love to share with you later. Outreach and also education. So anything from blog posts to the classes that we teach are, you know, fall under that. And then we also realize that even though we're passionate about empowering people to learn how to cook for themselves and transform raw materials into the most nourishing forms for their family, we realize that there is a need also to create that food itself. So we have a restaurant called the Modern Stone Age Kitchen, which is where we put it into practice. And I will tell you, we started that about a year and a half ago. Well, it sort of started earlier. My daughter started a sourdough bread company, and it turned into this about a year and a half ago. And now we have 19 people working for us, and we are creating amazing food. And we have people traveling from all over the country. In fact, in some cases, people from other countries have even come to visit. And I'm really proud of what we've been able to create here.
That's incredible. I didn't realize you had that many employees.
We've been expanding. You know, here's the crazy thing. The town that we live in, Chestertown, Maryland, is a super cute, historic, awesome town on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. If you were to tell me, listen, here's some money, go start this business, it sounds great, where would you put it? I wouldn't put it here. Like, I wouldn't. There's so many things working against creating a restaurant like we've created. I mean, the man and woman power needed to create the food that we're creating is unbelievable. So I would have thought somewhere where, you know, a bunch of hip 20 something year olds that are really into health and, you know, would be the place to put this. And just because of the circumstances that led to its creation, we're here in Chestertown, Maryland, and here it is booming. We're, you know, we literally can't keep up. It's fantastic. So, you know, so many people told me years ago, you're never going to be able to keep up cooking like you do for your family. And we were able to do it. And now we've taken the next step. And not only are we creating that food for the family, we're creating that food for the community. And there are no two ingredients put together outside of our walls. So here, real quick, just for people listening, we use ancestral and traditional approaches to food to transform raw ingredients into their safest and most nourishing forms possible. Fermentation is at the core of almost everything that we do. Any grains or flours that we have go through a full, wild, long fermented sourdough process. Any maize we have is nishtamalized. We have a strong stance. We don't use any industrial nut and seed oils. We don't use any refined sugars. Our dairy is fermented, and, you know, the list goes on and on. Those are the things that we stand on to create the food that we're creating. And it is economically viable. I mean, we're not, we're still, you know, very careful and cautious about money here for sure. But the fact that not only is it working, but we've grown and have been able to employ more people is really, really exciting.
You should be very, very proud of that. That to me makes me feel so optimistic that maybe the pendulum is swinging. Like the pendulum that went so hard the other way towards the food pyramid and made everybody sick and on medications and not able to enjoy their lives. You just wonder, like, is that going to cause this like swell that's going to finally go back the other direction, back in the way that we evolved? That makes me so happy. And I just want to point out here, since you've been around the world, you've taken a look archaeologically at history, you've also seen up close these indigenous peoples, people that have lived, you know, the way we lived and understanding history. Were these people suffering? Like, do they have awful lives out in the sticks now? Now, since we farmed over all the best places, they're in the worst places in the world, least viable for us to, you know, farm over and shove Bibles down their throats. Like, are people, are humans designed just to get by?
No, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because so many times somebody asked me about working with these people, and our vision is, oh, they're hunter-gatherers, oh, they're nomadic pastoralists, whatever they're doing, they're living in these amazing environments and then just crushing it. At some level, they're still crushing it in many ways, but they're living in these marginal environments. You know, all the best land in this world are covered in you know, been taken up by the modern industrial world. I mean, the cities are in places where ancient civilizations were, which were put in places where ancient hunter-gatherers were, because they were the best places to be. So the people that I'm working with are in many ways living lives that are very similar to the way they've been living for a very, very long time. But in most cases, they're doing it in places where they wouldn't have chose to be. They've been pushed there in very marginal environments. And I will tell you, there's a couple of standards for all the people that my family and I have been with, and all the work we've done with them. Number one, it's the diversity is the standard, right? Everybody does something a little bit different, right? But as far as the things that really are the same, true, you know, just soul warming happiness is, you know, what it truly means to be human is what we get from these people. My, you know, my family has been taken in into some of these places, which, you know, you can, it's almost impossible to even get to. And they've been welcomed into the homes there, and homes of people that are living in a one bedroom house, and give us, you know, I've been around people who don't have access to all the materials that they wish they could, usually for economic reasons, that literally have the opportunity to eat meat once a week, that saved it for when me and my family came to share it with us. I mean, that's the kind of level, and never have we felt unsafe. Never. It's just this love and camaraderie and humanness that just is just oozing. I mean, I don't even know. I just, when I think of the experiences, it's always, you know, the flashes in my head of the memories are always about hugging and smiling and laughing and sharing incredible food and stories. And that's what it's been. And that's what I hope it continues to be. But yeah, that's exactly what it was.
That's amazing. You mentioned Dr. Anthony Chafee, and listening to your episode that you did on his podcast, describe being in Mongolia and the couple that you were with and making a rope, like the strength, the dexterity, the knowledge, the wisdom, like it's so interesting to live in this modern world and try to incorporate some of those things. And a lot of that is food. A lot of that is our nutrition. And when I steal your line and tell it to somebody, when I tell it to one of my clients, that we are not really designed to eat most, if any, of the food that we actually consume, that really blows people's minds. And people are like, whoa, what are you talking about? And you start to describe, like if I divide this into plant foods and animal foods, you're not really designed to do either one. You're designed to use technologies to make them safe for you to consume. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah. So first off, for everybody that hasn't listened to any of the earlier podcast, as far as technology is concerned, technology is required. Some technological input is required for almost every single food that we eat at some level. And we've been inserting technology, creating technologies to transform raw materials in our diets for at least 3.3 million years. 3.3 to 3.4 is the earliest we have evidence for right now. And at that time, they were very simple stone tools that were created and used. But don't be fooled by the simplicity of the tool. It is a powerful tool. The ability to create a razor sharp, durable edge, something that's sharper and more durable than anything we have on our body, immediately transformed our relationship with everything around us. We could now butcher and scrape and cut and saw and do all those things that we didn't have the ability to do before. Now, for most of us, that doesn't maybe mean a whole lot, but imagine if I ripped away all of your scissors, all of your knives, all of your razor blades, all of your razors, anything that we use to cut anything, and said, do something. You couldn't do anything. Like you literally couldn't do anything. And we live in a world where most of the things are already cut for us. So transformative technologies like stone tools, fermentation, fire, hunting, nishtamalization, and the ability to create pottery and put it on top of a fire, all those sorts of things transformed our relationship with the environment and our relationship with food. The other example that I usually give is, okay, imagine if I stripped you down completely naked and threw you in the middle of the woods wherever you live. For most people listening, especially this time of year, I know you and I were chatting real quick before we got on this, you have, 50 inches of snow this year where you live?
Almost 500 it's a very
almost 500 in the mountains. I'm here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. We've seen a few flurries, but it's freezing cold. I was sitting in the goose blind all day this morning, and it was freezing, and I had like 7 layers of clothes on. It is very humbling immediately because most of us would die from exposure, right, if that was the case. So number one, that tells us that we require technologies to live in most of the places. This isn't equatorial Africa, right? This is other parts of the world. So we need technologies to even make it because of exposure. But even if it was the middle of the summer, wherever you live, and it was nice and I say, okay, now go eat. Okay, great. There's wild plants and, maybe I can get a rat or something like that. But the reality is any one of us, and I don't care how great your survival skills are, I don't care if you could identify every plant in front of you and you knew the behavior patterns of every animal that was in the woods with you, the reality is you would die of starvation. The human body, over millions of years of evolutionary changes that were supported by technological innovations that transformed our diets, we created bodies that require nutrition that we just can't get on our own. Not with our fingernails, our eyes, our muscles, our speed or lack of speed. We just can't access the materials. And even if we could access all the raw materials with any technology, which we can't, but even if we could, our digestive tracts are incredibly weak. We haven't had to rely solely on our digestive tracts to transform a raw material into nutrition for our bodies for over 3 million years. So we require these technological inputs. Many of us don't think about it that way. But if you just think about the technologies you use today, from the moment you got up to the moment you're listening to this podcast, I mean, how many technologies did you use? From a knife to a Vitamix to a stove to a microwave to the coffee machine. I mean, all of these things are technological inputs. So this is where, when I mentioned earlier, this is the how. How do we as humans take a raw material and transform it into its safest and most nourishing form possible for our body? So real quick, let me just say something about the safe and the nourishing part, because I keep saying that over and over again. The nourishing part, there's two parts to that. One is nutrient density. So we humans have these incredibly large bodies and these incredibly large nutrient-needy brains that require massive nutrition. And I don't just mean in the form of calories. Calories, the right kinds of proteins, the right kinds of fats, macronutrients, micronutrients, all the things that we need it and we need a lot of it, which means we get a lot of return when the foods we eat are incredibly nutrient dense. But just as importantly, especially for us with these incredibly inefficient digestive tracts, we need those nutrients to be bioavailable to our bodies or accessible to our bodies. Just because we eat it doesn't mean our bodies get the nutrition in the right way to go to where it needs. In fact, for most of us in the modern world, for a lot of different reasons, whether it's because we have irritable bowel syndrome or because we're eating food that hasn't been processed properly, the reality is even those of us who put a lot of nutrition into our mouths, a large majority of it goes right out the other end and doesn't get to where it needs to be. So that's the bioavailability part. It needs to be in the right state for our bodies to access it properly. But the other piece of that, the safety piece, seems weird. Like, I keep talking about safety. He keeps saying the safety. Does he mean like, you know, the milk has to be pasteurized so it doesn't kill us? No, no, no. What I mean is, especially in the plant world, and again, Anthony Chaffee is the one who's kind of spearheading a lot of this right now, and I guess Paul Salat, a lot of people are, but the idea plants are, they say plants are trying to kill you. I tone that down just a hair because plants don't really care about us at all. But the reality is plants are not on this earth to feed us. Plants are here to do the same thing that every other living organism on this planet is trying to do: reproduce, survive, reproduce viable offspring, and that offspring survives and reproduces viable offspring so the species can continue. And the way the plants do it is through chemical warfare and biological warfare, creating all sorts of different toxins that are present in literally every single plant that we have. So the tech and crazy thing is, and it sounds like you've heard me say this before, we've created and used technologies in our dietary past for including animals and plants in our diets. And there's a big difference between what those technologies were used for. So number one, as far as animals are concerned, most of the technologies developed to help include animals in our diet were about overcoming our physical limitations and getting the animal, because it's very difficult for us to, you know, jump on animals and rip them apart. So it's for hunting technology, things like bows and spears and atlatls and boomerangs, or fishing technologies, so there's nets or hooks or traps. All those things were created to help us overcome our limitations and access these animals. And once we have that animal, animal food sources represent the most nutrient-dense, bioavailable nutrition humans have ever had access to. So all you need is a sharp edge. Once you have the animal, a sharp edge to get into that animal. The blood, the fat, the organs, the most nutrient-dense bioavailable parts of those animals, the nutrition in that those parts are readily accessible. We can just dive right in. It's already safe. In almost every case, there's nothing we have to detoxify about those foods. Heck, we don't even have to cook them. In fact, cooking sometimes with some of those foods, like the organ meat, sometimes a little bit can degrade some of the bioavailability of the nutrients. The meat cooking help with, there's a little bit of research that suggests it's a little bit easier for the human body to access all of the nutrients in raw red meat by physically processing it a little bit, by chopping it up. And then a little bit of cooking can help a little bit. But again, we're talking about minutiae here because it's so incredibly nutrient dense. All that food's there, it's safe and nutrient dense. Plants are a completely different thing. Up until the agricultural revolution, which started about 12,000 years ago, depending on where you are in the world, that everything changes then. So pre-agricultural use of plants in our diets, the technologies, almost every single technology created to include plants in our diets, didn't have to do with getting the plants. Heck, plants are super easy. Okay, you need a digging stick to dig up some roots. Maybe it helps if you have a basket to collect berries. But for the most part, you're talking about collective foraging, just grabbing and pulling things, right? Getting the foods don't require a lot of technological input. What requires technological input is making those plant foods safe and unlocking the nutrients so our bodies, our inefficient digestive tract, can do something with the nutrition that's there. Every single plant on this planet has some level of toxin in them. That doesn't mean all of those toxins are going to kill you. That doesn't even mean that all of those toxins are going to really harm you in a way you can, you're going to recognize. All of them have toxins. Some of them will kill you. Some of them will make you sick. Some of them will build up over time. The really dangerous ones are the ones that are going to build up over time, and you're going to feel the effects years or decades down the line. But detoxifying plants is a strategy that our ancestors developed over millions of years, and making those nutrients in the cells of the plants available to our bodies is another very important use of technology.
Okay, awesome. Very well explained. I love that. We're going to talk about plants and the detoxification of plants. You mentioned animal products. When I think of nourishment, I'm, you know, coming on 4 years of being carnivore, so I'm going to think animal foods for sure. I was going to ask you about cooking, so I'm glad you you know, kind of responded to that without me asking. I was wondering why we evolved to cook our food more so than just eating, you know, the raw products of the animals. And it sounds like we can do that okay, as long as we're mindful of a few things. So that's very interesting. I'm glad that you went there with that. But you also mentioned organs and you mentioned nutrient density. So that's great. We all know that we can have organs and they have a lot of nutrients in them. So if some is good, more must be better, correct?
That's a very good point. So and this is something I just started talking about recently, because I think we've only had to start talking about this recently. One of the things that people ask me all the time is, okay, they've heard that liver is an incredible superfood. First of all, I hate the word superfood, but liver is an incredibly nutrient-dense bioavailable food, as are other organs. But liver seems to be the one that is the poster child right now for a lot of this nose-to-tail approaches. And I am a huge advocate of nose-to-tail approaches to butchering, cooking, and eating for a variety of different reasons. But the three most important ones are for nourishment, for making sure we're eating ethically, and also to make sure we're eating sustainably. So there's very important reasons to do this. But the question that I'm getting asked all the time now is, it used to be, if we were talking 5 years ago, the two questions I would always get asked are, should humans be eating bread and should humans be consuming dairy as adults? Those are the two questions I always got asked. Now, the question that I'm getting asked all the time is, all right, how much liver should I eat? Like, liver's so very important. Like, how much do I eat? And what dawned on me is that I never asked myself that question. And the reason I never asked myself that question is because I grew up hunting. I've spent a lot of time with hunter-gatherers and just people, you know, intensely connected to their food and where it comes from for the past several decades. It's a question they've never asked. And it's a question we have to ask now because of the way the modern food system is and how compartmentalized it is. I used to sort of rail against people that were just saying, okay, I know I need protein in my diet and maybe animal sources are the best place for it. So I'm going to eat lean chicken breast every night, or anytime I'm going to have meat. So they go to the store and they just get chicken breast. And I said, that's absurd. Like, that isn't anything like what eating in the past was like. Like, what about the rest of the chicken? It's so weird that we can go to the grocery store and just buy packages of chicken breast and not buy anything else in the chicken. In fact, we could, if we had blinders on, we could walk to we know the spot in the grocery store, walk right to the chicken breast, not see any other meat, anything else, anything that resembled an animal, walk right back to the, and check out with it. And to me, that's incredibly weird. But now we're at a place where, oh, now we've got this label on liver, which again is an amazing food. Do not get me wrong, but we can do the same thing with liver. We can go to Whole Foods and buy 10 pounds of chicken liver, not see another part of a chicken, go home, and then we have to ask ourselves, how much liver should I be eating? The people that I've worked with, the approach that I've always had, if you ask somebody 10,000 years ago, how much liver should you eat? They look at you crazy and say, what kind of question is that? And they look at the animal they just killed and say, hey, how much liver does that have? That's how much I'm going to eat. And I'm going to eat the spleen and the kidney and the heart and the tongue and the brains and the fat and the meat and the marrow. And then I'm going to go kill another animal. And that's how much liver I'm going to eat on the next animal. And that's, you know, our disconnection from our food and the compartmentalization of the modern industrial food system has made it so that we have to ask these silly questions now. The idea that liver is amazing is a wonderful idea. The fact that we have people that are really strongly advocating for eating organ meats and blood and fat and all that is amazing. But I don't want that pendulum to swing so far the other way that it gets absurd either. The reality is that anybody here should be able to figure out those answers to those questions themselves. You just have to sit down and think, what is it really like operating in a real food system where you're incredibly connected to it? And, you know, if I got a whole chicken, which is the way we should be doing it, right? Get a whole chicken, bring it home, eat the whole thing, make bone broth, eat the heart, eat the liver, eat the gizzard, do the whole thing, and then go get another chicken. You know, that is, or when you go to the butcher and you get a whole, you know, hopefully you can get to a butcher and you go get a shoulder of a pig or the back end of a pig and you bring it home. Say, hey, can I get half a liver too? And maybe I'll get the heart, you know, and the next time you go to the butcher, do the same thing again. If eating a massive amount of liver every day is just as absurd as eating nothing but chicken breast every day.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Thank you for that explanation. I get tons of questions about organ meats. I also get tons of questions about dairy. I love the way you explain how dairy should be incorporated into our diets and how it's actually a little bit weird that some people can consume cow dairy. Can you explain, you know, the role of dairy in our lives and where we should find the safest version of dairy?
Yeah, you know what's very strange? We were talking earlier too about the Chatting Fit podcast. He took a piece of my what I said about almond milk. We were talking about oxalates and, you know, the difference between almond milk and you know how amazing milk can be. And I have never had any comment I've made go as viral as that comment. There are, you know, on one side I have like, I think it's like 12 or 13,000 likes at the moment on that little clip. And on the other side, I mean, daily, I am getting vegan hate mail about how dare you say anything bad about almond milk. I never knew anybody was just that passionate about almond milk. Dairy, we spent the past several minutes talking about all the ways that our human body is not designed to eat almost all the foods that we eat without some sort of technological input. One thing I like to say, so humans are omnivores. There are some who would disagree. You know, Anthony Chaffee, for example, suggests that we're obligate carnivores. And he makes a very strong argument for that as well. My take is slightly different, and it's really taking into account the technological input required in our diets that has been there for millions of years. I say, yeah, we are omnivores, but we're not omnivores by design. We're omnivores by technology. We cannot eat all of these foods, especially plant foods, without the assistance of technology. But we can, I truly believe, incorporate a lot of these foods into our diet if we approach them the right way. That said, the only food that I think humans are perfectly biologically designed to consume is dairy. And that is only for a short period of our lives, right? We are mammals, and that it makes complete sense. And the quick version of a much longer, long drawn out story is when, you know, we as mammals, the way that we approach dairy in a safe way is we are perfectly designed to consume it. And what happens is as infants, you know, every step here, so just give me like 30 seconds to explain this. Every step that I'm going to lay out is important for making this all work. Number one, when we're drinking from our mothers, the milk inside of our mothers is at body temperature. The milk inside of, which makes sense. The milk inside of our mothers at body temperature is teeming with live bacteria that are designed to operate at that temperature. I mean, all of this makes complete evolutionary sense, right? So when we drink from our mothers, we're getting this milk that's coming out at body temperature, teeming with bacteria, good, amazing, beneficial bacteria that are designed to operate at that temperature, and it goes right into our mouths. And when it goes into our bodies, we as infants are creating several different enzymes that help us properly digest that milk in a safe and nourishing way. One of it is, so ACE, a word ending in ACE means it's an enzyme. So lipase is an enzyme that works on lipids or fat, so it breaks those down. So we have lipase, we have lactase, which is the enzyme that helps us break down the sugars. Lactose, which for anyone listening that's lactose intolerant, that's the enzyme your body's no longer making as an adult. And also, depending on the mammal, we have chymosin or a chymosin-like enzyme that is a protease enzyme, which works on the proteins in milk and helps digest the proteins or helps do things to the proteins. And what happens in our bodies, what the protease enzyme does, is it sort of denatures the proteins and turns that liquid into something that resembles more like cottage cheese. And because it is, what we're doing is we're slowing down a liquid, especially for us infants. Any mammal that's consuming dairy is consuming just that liquid, and liquids pass through our digestive tracts entirely too fast for us to completely break them down, for us to absorb the nutrients adequately from the food. So what nature's figured out, and it isn't just humans, it's mammals in general, if we denature the proteins and turn it into something that's more like a semi-solid, two very important things can happen. One is in addition to the chemical breaking down that's going on, we can physically, our stomachs can physically work on something that's a little bit more solid to help break it down. But more importantly, it slows it down. And by slowing it down, we allow it to ferment longer in our stomachs, which is a very important processes happening through that fermentation. And when it makes it to our small intestines, and everything's broken down properly, it's there a little bit longer so the nutrients can get absorbed through our intestinal walls and literally nourish our bodies. Now, that's great. So we have raw milk teeming with live bacteria at the right temperature, slowing down, fermenting in our bodies, completely transforming and nourishing us. When we, and this doesn't just go for humans, it goes for mammals in general. When we start to get weaned, we mammals get weaned off of our mothers and choose solid foods, we start suppressing or losing the ability to create some of those enzymes that we just no longer need. And one of them is the lactase, the one that helps break down the sugar lactose in milk. What's weird, it isn't weird for humans to be lactose intolerant. What's weird is for us humans that are continuing to create the enzyme lactase into adulthood so we can safely digest the sugars in the milk. 60% of modern humans today are lactose intolerant. Only 40% of us are at some level lactose tolerant as adults. And the ones that are lactose tolerant are so because somewhere in our ancestral line, and it's almost always because we have heritage in either a couple of different places in Europe or a couple of different places in Africa, where there was a genetic mutation that allowed us to continue to create what we call lactase persistence, or we're creating lactase, that enzyme into adulthood. So it's not weird to be lactose intolerant. It's actually weird to be lactose tolerant. In most cases, people who haven't had a lot of dairy in their ancestral past, like the Native Americans, didn't develop that genetic mutation to continue to produce that enzyme. So most Native Americans are lactose intolerant at some level. On the other hand, places like Ireland, which have a long history of an association with dairy being very important in their diets, are for the most part lactose. You see a high lactose persistence into adulthood there. So now we have this question, like I said earlier, one of the questions was, should humans be consuming dairy as adults? You know, we're not designed to consume dairy. Well, as soon as somebody says we're not designed to consume something, it's, whoa, hold on. We're not designed to consume almost every food that we eat. Most of the people that are anti-dairy at the moment, most, are at some coming from the vegan world. And if, you know, my response to that is almost every food that you consume, literally every food that you consume requires massive technological input to make it safe and allow the nutrients that are in it to be available to your body. So you could very easily make that same argument. We're not designed to consume grains. I mean, think about the massive amount of fossil fuel input put into a fields to get the grains and growing them and storing them and processing. We're not designed, obviously, to consume them either. So the question, are we designed to consume it, is not a question that's a valid question in my mind. The question that at least I always ask when I approach a food is, how can I make that raw ingredient as safe and nourishing as possible? And if that's the question about dairy, here's what it is. Number one, the dairy should be as high quality as possible, and it should be raw if at all possible. And I realize in this country that it's a huge hurdle and about half the states are in, but if you have access to high quality raw dairy, that's a great place to start. Unfortunately, even though that's an important thing, most conversations stop there. High quality raw dairy is not, you know, by ingesting a glass of high quality raw milk, we're not completely replicating what happened when we were infants drinking from our mother's milk. When we were drinking from our mothers, not only was it raw, but it was also in this process of fermenting. Fermented raw dairy, in my mind, is the absolute gold standard for safety and nourishment when it comes to dairy. And when I say fermenting, I'm talking about things like kefir, clabber, high quality cheeses. And that can be anything from the most expensive cheese at the grocery store to an incredible cream cheese. Is a real cream cheese is a fermented product. Yogurt is another fermented dairy product. Fermented butter is absolutely amazing. And even though butter's been around for probably between 5,000 and 6,000 years, almost the majority of that time, the butter was fermented. And most of the butter that we have at least access to in this country is what we call sweet cream butter, and has never been through the fermentation process. The cool thing about fermented dairy is that it is incredibly easy to do in your own home. Making fermented butter, making real amazing fermented yogurt, making real cream cheeses, even making certain kinds of cheeses is something that's very accessible to do in your house. And, you know, you have better access to raw milk to use in your house than you do in most commercial venues.
Wow. Well, that was an absolute clinic on dairy. Thank you for sharing that. I can tell you've been very intentional and thoughtful about all your research into dairy. And I just learned a ton of new things that I didn't previously know. Let's talk about plant toxins. I don't really love the word superfood unless it appears on a certain book called Toxic Superfoods by a certain Sally K. Norton. Amazing book. And you obviously had it in your hands well before it was released to the public. What an amazing book. When we talk about plant toxins, why is it that one toxin, oxalate, keeps coming up? It's like the gold standard of all the plant toxins. Why is that one so harmful?
There's a lot of reasons, but the reason that I think oxalate, so let me just back up real quick. Toxic Superfoods, it was just released in January, so this month, and by Sally Norton, who's a good friend of mine, and you have got to get this book. There's two books this year for health from a health perspective that I think are the gold standard must gets. Number one is Toxic Superfoods by Sally Norton, and the other that I'm just starting now. She's a good friend of mine, an incredible person, incredible voice in the health field is Fast Like a Girl by Dr. Mindy Peltz. And so I realized Fast Like a Girl, and it is targeted towards women, but the information in this book is, you know, gold standard for anybody reading it, male or female. So those are my two reads for this year. And I haven't finished Fast Like a Girl yet, but Toxic Superfoods, I poured through 6 months ago. It was amazing. And that's coming from somebody who's been attuned to oxalates for, you know, years now. And I still learned a ton by reading this book. Yep. I will say in many ways, Sally Norton literally saved my life. And a lot of the things that I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast about the health that I'm enjoying now, a lot of it was dietary changes I made on my own based upon my research, but a lot of it has to do with recommendations made by Sally Norton and getting oxalates out of my diet. The reason that I think oxalates are so incredibly dangerous is because, let me back up. I started foraging when I was 10 years old. Foraging was the one thing in my life and in my connection with the outdoors and food and that didn't come from my parents. You know, my mother had me in the kitchen. My father had me hunting and fishing and trapping. But foraging was something I was drawn to for some reason. And they didn't really have a lot of experience in it. And it was something I kind of took on myself and spent, the past 40 years doing it. And for the past 25, 30 years, I've been teaching foraging classes literally all over the world. And the way I approach it has changed for many reasons I'm going to mention in a minute, but I've been attuned to the at some level, because my association with plants in my diet didn't just come from the grocery store. We automatically assume everything's safe for us. It came from knowing I need to identify this plant because there's so many toxins in the plant world and so many dangers and poisons that I need to be really careful with it. And even when I do get a plant, there's something I have to do to it to make it a little bit safer to eat. So my mind was already sort of in that place for a while. But with most of those toxins, in most cases, a plant has toxins not because it's evil. A plant has a toxin because it serves a purpose for the plant, right? And one other thing we have to remember is all the life living on this earth, things that they're doing, ways that they're behaving, parts of their bodies that are growing or things that are happening, there's always a trade-off with energy or other things where a plant isn't going to create a toxin just to create a toxin. It is nutritionally expensive for a plant to create something like that in its life. And there's a damn good reason that they're doing it, because it provides some sort of protective mechanism so that a part of what they need to do for survival is ensured. And it doesn't make sense in most cases for plant toxins, for a plant to create a toxin and an animal to eat the plant and kill it and then go off and die. Days later, or get sick days later. You know, it makes more sense. And most plant toxins are set up so that, you know, you take a bite of it, you're like, whoa, there's a taste or a smell or a reaction right away that says, I don't want to eat any more of it. And the plant's allowed to survive, right? And a plant can continue to live and grow and reproduce. So, and anybody who's listening who knows, who are foragers know that, you know, you can get that taste, like tannic acid has a taste to it. And you can, it's almost impossible to poison yourself with tannic acid because you just can't ingest enough of it. It's too bitter and too nasty for you to do it, right? But, and in most cases with plant toxins, you know pretty quick, you either know right away, or, you know, that night you're at minimum, your stomach's upset, or you're in the hospital with kidney failure, liver failure, you know, right away. And when those toxins, you would think I would consider more dangerous than something like oxalates, but I actually don't. For the individual who died, you know, it's more dangerous. But as a community or for a population of people, or even a family unit around or a clan around that person, they can say, oh, they ate that plant. And a couple hours later, this happened to them, right? That is, again, for that person, it's incredibly dangerous. But for a community, they can recognize that there's a problem there. The problem with oxalates, the real danger with oxalates, is that in most cases, it requires months or years of ingesting the plants that are high in oxalates for you to start to build up an oxalate toxicity level that it's very noticeable. And by the time that that happens, you know, you're like, no, I'm not sick now because of the spinach that I've been eating for the past 15 years. I've been eating for 15 years. But the reality is because you've been eating it for 15 years that it's built up and you have this issue. And that's, I think, one of the problems right now for so many people. Like, no, this isn't the case. I mean, like that almond, the post I mentioned earlier, that little thing from the Chatting Fit podcast, I mentioned the dangers of almond milk and the fact that there are children under the age of 10 that are presenting with kidney stones in families that have replaced cow's milk with almond milk. And everybody's, no, I drink almond milk and I'm fine. Like, yeah, but you've been drinking almond milk for 6 months. Wait 3 more years and you're going to have a huge, huge issue. Oxalates, I think, are one of, and luckily, so luckily, it's one of the things now that people are finally talking about. And it's probably going to be one of the hot topics, I think, for the entire year that people are talking about, and they should be. And one of the other dangers with oxalates is they're so prevalent the name of Sally's book, Toxic Superfoods, is the perfect title. It's so prevalent in foods that we've labeled superfoods that, the people that have adopted those as major parts of their diets have gotten to that point. And they're like, oh no, this is it. I'm here. I'm saved. I don't need to eat carbs anymore because I can replace all the baked goods with almond flour, you know, make them out of almond flour and I'm fine. And I can still have my whatevers, but you know, my pancakes in the morning, but you know, and they don't realize that, oh my gosh, they're literally poisoning themselves. Almonds were my issue, but for hopefully people listening to this, this is not the first time you've heard about oxalates, but the quick 13-second version of this is, they are a toxin that look like little shards of glass under a microscope. They cause two things. One is they rob your body of potassium and magnesium and calcium, right? This was number one problem. And number two, they can create massive trauma in all sorts of different parts of your body. They're very hard to detect in your body. Very prevalent problems that we know are related to oxalates are things like kidney stones or in many cases, gout is actually not a problem. It's caused by uric acid. It's caused by oxalate instead. There's four things that can cause gout. The only one we talk about is uric acid, unfortunately. You can have problems with your corneas, problems with areas that have had trauma before, extremity, all sorts of issues you can have as a result of oxalates. And secondly, very quickly, some of the foods that are the worst culprits for oxalate toxicity, spinach, Swiss chard, rhubarb, almonds, nuts in general, which is very hard for people to listen to, or very hard for people to hear, because I was one of those people, nuts were my go-to snack, almonds are what got me in big trouble. Almond or nut-based milks have the oxalates carry over into it. So they're there as well. as far as oils and extracts go, they don't carry over into the oils and extracts. There's a lot of reasons not to consume industrial nut and seed oils. Oxalates are not one of those issues, but there's a lot of other reasons not to. But extracts, so if you're cooking and you kind of want that almond flavor, but you don't want the oxalates, almond extract doesn't have it in, right? So those poppy seeds and sesame seeds are off the charts high. And it doesn't seem like necessarily that these things we use as garnishes or whatever are very big deals. But if you look at the oxalate load in poppy seeds and sesame seeds, and you're using everything spice in your cooking, then you should really be aware of how high they really are. And there's some other foods as well, but those are the big ones.
Yeah. I saw a magazine cover not too long ago that had this cornucopia of all these different plant foods, all the different colors and all the different, you know, colors of the rainbow. And I looked at that and I thought, you know what, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have looked at that and not only would I have thought that that was super healthy, but I just said like, wow, that looks good. Like I could eat all those look great. And looking at it today, not only do I realize that that is absolute toxic sludge, but it's also like repulsive. I can't even look at it without like, oh my God, like I could not eat those foods if I wanted to. And on that note, you recently have decided to try a carnivore diet. So I want to know, how is the experiment going so far? And has it so far changed your thinking around preparing plant foods?
That's a really, really good question. So yeah, my wife and I eat a very low carb diet anyhow. And since I became aware of the dangers of oxalates in plants, we've had a very low oxalate diet as well. So the plants that we have consumed have been ones that are low in oxalates. And when we do consume they're low in carbs and they're low in oxalates. And we do consume plants, I'm always mindful not only of making sure the ones that are high in toxins are not there, but the ones that we do consume are prepared in the right way. Remember, I mentioned the role of technology in plants in our diets forever. So fermentation, it depends on the plant and it depends on the toxin, but fermentation is one of the best ways in most plants to make it as safe and nourishing as it can be. And I just love the way it changes textures and flavors and aromas in plants anyhow. So fermentation is, if anybody's looking for a place to start, fermentation is it. And, you know, just make simple sauerkraut and you've transformed it. The other cool thing as a side note about fermentation with plants is that for those of you who are interested in a low carb diet, fermentation, the food for the bacteria are the sugars and the starches in the plant. So a fermented food automatically has less carbs in it than the raw or even cooked version of that same plant. But anyhow, that's another topic. My wife and I did carnivore last year strictly for a week. And I know it takes longer than that to really see the majority of the effects, but we felt fantastic. One of the problems here is, we're running a restaurant. All the food we're creating is the healthiest versions that it can be, but some of it is not in line with carnivore. And we do have to taste. We do have to try a little bit of things as we're working. But we said we were going to try it for a month this year, and we are doing a very, very good job. Two things that are important. One is there's been some tasting going on that we've had to do. Although we did 2 weeks incredibly strict. Not even any tasting for the 2 weeks, anything. We've had to do a little bit of tasting. And for my 50th birthday, Mindy Peltz changed my mind about something. I was one of those people who, if I cheated, right, on a diet, no matter what the diet was, whether it was South Beach or Atkins or whatever it was, whatever my mindset was that I was the way I was going to eat, if I cheated even a little bit, or if I strayed even a little bit, I viewed it as cheating. And my mind would go into a spiral. I know so many people listening are probably in the same boat. And what would have been one bite of something turned into an entire pack of Oreos and a pack of chips and the whole thing. And I considered it a cheat day. I'd start again the next day. And one little thing that I mentioned, or Mindy Peltz had mentioned to me and helps me a lot with that, is this: first of all, the mindset of cheating is a negative mindset. Right. It's one of failure. She changed that word to feasting. Right. So it's feasting. And the other word she changed in it was meal. So instead of a cheat day, I turned it into a feast meal, right? Where it's like, it's something smaller. I didn't have that feeling of guilt and my whole day didn't go into a downward spiral. So we've sort of embraced that with this carnivore. And listen, I think carnivore is amazing. And the fact that we didn't and haven't been 1000% strict on it for this month speaks more to our lifestyle and what we have to do for the business here than anything else. But I did have a feast meal on my birthday. We went, a buddy of mine's a chef at a local restaurant, Fiola Mar, in Georgetown, and they served us a meal that by any standard was not only healthy, but extravagant. we enjoyed every bit of it. And again, with that mindset of a feast meal, the next day back on track with everything. Has it changed the way, the other part of that question was, has being carnivore changed the way that I cook vegetables? Not so much, more, it's been more the past several years of including vegetables in our diets, some vegetables in our diets that have impacted the way that we approach them. And again, I'll say that fermentation is huge. I'll give you one example of the power of fermentation. And this two things, I want this to serve as an example of the how vastly different the same raw ingredient can be transformed into because of something like fermentation. But also when you think about it, I want you to think about, you know, that role of technology in our dietary past, how transformative it really was. It isn't just a talking point. It actually was that valuable. So a grape is my example for anybody who's in a low carb world. If you're eating, first of all, if you're carnivore, you wouldn't eat a grape anyhow. But if you're strict keto, you'd never eat a grape. A grape has some of the most sugar in the world and of any fruit in it. You're not going to eat a grape. So you're like, no, I don't want the grape. If I take that grape and put it through a yeast fermentation, I have transformed it. I've cut down the sugar and I've turned it into wine, right? So that grape is now wine. Now there's a lot of people in the keto world who will drink wine, especially like dry farm wine, no residual sugar. It's fantastic. So that fermentation process transformed that grape into something that not only is a mind-altering substance, but has little or no sugar in it whatsoever. A lot of other changes, but those are the two big ones. If I take that wine and I allow another fermentation to take place, this one that's responsible for the transformation through something called an acetobacter bacteria, it eats the alcohol and turns that red wine into red wine vinegar. Now, I know there's a, depending on how strict a carnivore you are, some carnivores will have a little vinegar, many will not, but definitely somebody in the keto world and most people that are following healthy diets other than maybe carnivore would all consider vinegar, a live vinegar, an incredibly healthy food. So we went from a grape, which would spike your blood sugar, to wine, which has no residual sugar, doesn't have to have any residual sugar, but will alter your mind, to vinegar, which is a completely different food, just because of allowing some bacteria, several trillion bacteria, but some bacteria to transform it for us. We don't even have to do a thing to it. And that's really the value of what some of these ancestral processes can do.
Wow, that's amazing. This has been such an awesome conversation, Dr. Bill Schindler. I value any time I get to talk with you. I've learned something every time. I don't know why I'm surprised that I always learn something. I always walk away with something new. And I know that when I listen to this again, I'll relearn some even more things. And so I'm so grateful for you and for all of your work and for how thoughtful you are with all of this. Can you please tell our audience where you want them to go to find you and connect with you and your work? And also, can you update us on some of the things that are coming down the road that you alluded to in the beginning of the show?
Absolutely. So number one, like I mentioned earlier, we have two major entities right now that my family and I and our whole team now that we have built operate. One is the Eastern Shore Food Lab, and you can find out about the Eastern Shore Food Lab, our nonprofit, at EasternShoreFoodLab.com, which will also take you to my website, which is eatlikeahuman.com, where all of our classes, blog posts, all that information is housed there. anybody who's interested in the restaurant, the Modern Stone Age Kitchen, can find us at modernstoneagekitchen.com. And if you're in the area, we're located in Chestertown, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. We're about a little over an hour from DC, about an hour and a half from Philly, about two and a half hours from New York City. So we're not far from any of those major cities, but we're in an incredibly beautiful rural area, historic town. Come and visit us. We are putting everything we have and creating the most nourishing food possible for anybody that comes through our doors and coming in to our place. It is a learning educational experience as well. We have taken down all the walls. You can see everything happening at the same time. And we also have what I've termed an open source kitchen. Now, our primary priority is empowering people to do these things for themselves. So if there's something we're doing, a recipe you want, a technique that we're employing, ask. We are happy to share. There's literally no secrets whatsoever. We just want to share it with the world. So those are the places to find us on the web. ES Food Lab is our Instagram handle for the nonprofit. Modern Stone Age Kitchen for the restaurant, and mine is Dr. Bill Schindler, Dr. Bill Schindler. So, upcoming things. So we're super excited for, like you mentioned earlier, the couple conferences we're going to, Low Carb Denver later in February, and I can't wait to see you there. KetoCon is in April?
April, correct.
April. I think the only other one we have on the books right now is the Vegas one in September, Low Carb Las Vegas. But I am so excited. We've spent partly due to COVID and partly due to the changes we were making when we were turning over the nonprofit and starting a restaurant, we haven't been able to engage in the research itself like I've wanted to for the past several years. We're finally kicking that back into gear. So I am hopeful. We're planting the seeds now that we have a huge, hopefully huge research trip to Sardinia in June.
Wow.
And which I'm super excited about. In fact, I just got word. When I come back, we're going to have to talk again because there's something that I have been working on for the past 5 years trying. And it's so funny we're talking. I've been trying to make a contact to learn this one thing for the past 5 years. And I thought I've exhausted every opportunity. And I'm not kidding. This morning I got a message that they've identified one person still knows how to do it. So I'm hopeful about that. I thought everybody had died that knew how to do this. So I can't wait to talk to you about that. And then in the next winter, we are looking to go above the Arctic Circle in Scandinavia and work with the Sami reindeer herders and learning some nose to tail approaches there. So
that's amazing.
We're back on track.
Dude, if you're feeling cold and layered up in Maryland, you better layer up for that trip.
Absolutely. In fact, we're doing it in the winter.
That's cool. Amazing. Dr. Bill Schindler, thank you again so very much for all of your content. And thank you for taking the time to be on the show today. We really, really appreciate you.
It was my pleasure. Always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Always good to see you as well. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. At the close of 1 year and the beginning of a new year, I just wanted to make sure to thank you, the listener, for all of your support and for listening to our show. 2022 was an amazing year that saw lots of growth with the podcast, but also came with amazing results with the people that we get to work with in our business, Boundless Body. We began our business during the confusion of the 2020 pandemic and opened up in July of that year, and we've been absolutely amazed with how things have gone. It was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of building the plane as we were flying it, but it's turned out amazing. We just absolutely love seeing our clients get amazing results. We love seeing all the great feedback and positive reviews that come through on Apple. So if you haven't already, please leave us a review there on Apple, as it's the best way for the show to continue to grow and impact the lives of people all over the world. We're super excited for 2023. We already have lots of great guests and topics lined up, and we have no intention of slowing down our releases anytime soon. Also, feel free to check out our premium content, which we post on Patreon. There you will find our extended and unedited episodes, which we post on the day of recording. So you actually don't have to wait for the edited version of the podcast to release, which can sometimes be several weeks, actually. And on Patreon, you will also find the Boundless Body Radio premium podcast. This was my special special project this year. I really wanted to combine all of the very best clips about one topic from our show to combine into extended episodes that take a very deep dive into a topic. I've created two separate topics as a masterclass that are three episodes each. One is all about the macronutrients, and the second is all about keto and ketogenic diets. That way you can get a fantastic education from some of our amazing guests in a format that can help you zero in on the topic that you are most interested in, something I'm very proud of and believe that we are sharing this content for a very high value. Remember that you can also book a complimentary 30-minute session with us on our website at myboundlessbody.com. And thank you again so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio.